Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians, all while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Yes, we are. Lynette was turning a light off. Oh, a very good morning to you. So glad that you're here. Welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Hey, Lynette, is my microphone working?
Your microphone is working. We just have a very big echo.
Okay.
Big echo. So we'll try to ignore that for a bit while our engineer gets that figured
finds
out.
Finds the right button to push and make it go away.
I don't have those buttons here.
Yeah, I know.
All right.
Well,
welcome. We have two wonderful doctors in the studio, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Michael Gilbert.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
And Dr. Gilbert from the Northwest Vision Institute. You are here. If you have eye questions, Dr.
This is the day.
Gilbert, this is the day. Dr. Gilbert is the one to ask, and he has all the information. So many times we will get people wanting to know, what do I do about this? Or tell me more about cataract surgery. And, you know, it's scary when it has to do
great.
With your eyes.
People get to call in with questions. No copay.
That's right.
Not
exactly.
And, of course, today you can tell us all about bicycling through the Netherlands.
Yes. Can we talk about that?
I'd love to.
All right. Let me give the phone number out there. So if you have a question for Dr. Jerry Mixon or Dr. Michael Gilbert, here is the number to call. It's 1-800-465-8770. Go ahead and get in that call queue. 1-800-465-8770. All right. So Dr. Gilbert, you were enjoying quite an adventure this summer. We got to catch up with you.
My wife and I over our 40 years of marriage, one of our favorite things to do is go biking. And we've done bike tours domestically and often internationally. She did from Berlin to Budapest. I jumped off at in Poland because I knew I had to get back and see patients, but she went on. A bunch of my friends who we used to bike with internationally. Last was New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And they decided we wanted to do one from Amsterdam to Bruges, Belgium. Along the waterways.
Oh.
And so you have a suite in a boat. And that boat, you have breakfast in the morning, and we had a gourmet chef. He was really fabulous. And then we go biking for the day, and then you meet up with him for the evening. And
on the canals again?
On the canals, right. So
really fabulous.
Fabulous. It was really great. Half of the group decided, it probably wasn't half, but many of them have decided to do the new e-bike thing.
Mm-hmm.
That just seems
you're old
like,
fashioned.
That just seems like, I think classic.
It's a bicycle.
I don't like to think of it as old fashioned. I like to
old
think
school?
Classic.
Yeah, classic.
You know, right? You know, but no question. If I'm going on a bike tour and I'm getting on an e-bike, what?
And right, you see
right?
Me riding. No, that's,
no, thank
yes.
you. I mean, that's just not it.
Oh, so. But I do love my e-bike. Can I just say
yes, ma'am.
I do love my e-bike because I can bike. And look like mine does look like a regular bike. So to those, I am biking and biking and biking. And then I just go farther than I normally would. Right. And I can go up and down those hills a little extra, but I'm always moving,
pedaling.
Always right. pedaling. So it's not like a motorcycle. Yeah, or even a little Vespa. But always pedaling, always pedaling. And I go further.
I did try it once. I tried it once.
Just once. Okay.
I was in Italy, and the rest of the group, we had a wonderful lunch at a winery. And everyone else said, huh, I don't think we should bike after, you know, the wine tasting.
Imbibing, yes.
Right, exactly. So, and I said, you know, I came here to bike. I paid for biking.
I want to
bike. I'm going to go biking. So I was the only one of the group. And so, you know, one of them who had an e-bike said, well, you can, you know, if you want to try it just for fun, why don't you use the e-bike? The two tour guides, one in Italy, one was an architect, and the other was a physicist.
Interesting.
But they couldn't get jobs in their preferred areas,
so they're bike tours,
right? So, but one had biked in the Tour de France.
Wow.
So, wow, they were great, really great, and intellectual, and you know, really good. So they said, fine, we'll take you back. But their job, they thought, was to make sure that the pace was at such a level that the e-bike would never kick in its power.
Yes, yes.
So they, because there's, it drops out after, at a certain speed. So they tried to keep me at a pace where it would never help me and instead just be a burden because of the weight.
I see.
Okay.
Oh, well.
It is heavier than a regular bike.
Yep.
Right.
Well, I'm glad you had a great time.
Great time.
Yes.
I was here just kind of slaving away.
Good.
Answering questions.
But learning medicine.
Healing
so,
the sick.
Yes.
So I always
yes.
look forward to our insights of the jour of the day to what's
well, we had
exciting.
We've had to work at it a little bit this summer. You know, 2 weeks ago yesterday, I had surgery on my back.
Right.
So I had surgery.
But then you were right back on the air.
Yes, he was.
As
yes.
if you had done, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't.
Me, I would have been, you know, yeah. holed up in bed for 2 weeks. And
no.
Not Jerry.
Not
no,
even no, not no, even 48 not hours and no, he was back.
I did
back.
The surgery on Thursday and worked half day Friday and then did the show on
here,
Saturday.
Early yes. morning on
of course.
Saturday.
Yeah, of course. But this morning I only did 2.5 miles instead of my customary
yes,
three.
Yes, right.
So.
Okay.
You're working up.
Taking it easy, yes. But yeah, I had a great time, you know, just, slaving away. And Samara, for those of you that are missing Dr. Umat, she is in India right now.
Yes.
She had, two weddings to attend.
Mm.
So when she gets
family
back,
wedding.
A couple of nieces, I
mm-hmm.
guess. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So she will return middle of the week, you know, with beautiful henna all the way up her hands and forearms and so on. Cause they always do this at the, you know, the Indian weddings. So, yeah. So, and of course, her patients always comment on her very elaborate decorations on her hands and arms.
Yeah, just beautiful,
back.
Beautiful.
So,
yeah.
At any rate, I've got lots of work for her to do when she gets back.
Yeah.
Party's over, dear.
Party's over. You've had your fun. Now, let's go.
There you go.
Okay. I do have a question here.
Okay.
That somebody emailed to me. Let me see if I can find where his question was. This is a fellow who wanted to know what his cholesterol numbers should be mm-hmm. and what a good diet for controlling cholesterol is. And so I sent him an email back, and I actually have that email here.
Oh, wow. Oh, very good.
And it's a substantial one.
It's substantial. It's because his question is reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
It's also doesn't have an easy answer. And so, you know, what is the best diet to control your cholesterol and what should your cholesterol numbers be?
Yeah.
And the reality is it all depends on a whole lot of stuff. So let me kind of go over a little cholesterol teaching for the group today. That's why you're all deciding what you're going to call about, okay?
Okay.
And for those who are eating breakfast now.
That's right.
Right.
Well, I had a big
right.
breakfast this morning. Yeah, yeah. But, I always have a big breakfast, a moderate lunch, and then no dinner. So, but cholesterol is the mother hormone. All of the steroid hormones in your body are made out of cholesterol. So, pregnenolone, testosterone, progesterone, estradiol, cortisol, all of these hormones that we depend on for our life are made out of cholesterol. So cholesterol is a critically important component. You don't want to get rid of all of it. In addition to that, every cell in your body, your brain and your muscle cells are burning cholesterol directly. Cholesterol metabolism is critical for cellular function in life. So it's important for us for two reasons. One, we use it directly, and two, we make it into a whole lot of other stuff we need to have. So what's happening to us, though, is when we're young, we have nice cholesterol levels, and we're burning it directly. Our brain is burning it, our muscles are burning it, and our end organs, our adrenal glands, are turning it into pregnenolone, dehydroepiandrosterone, progesterone. Your testicles are making it into testosterone. Your ovaries, the ladies, are turning it into both estrogens and testosterone. And so we've got this constant supply of cholesterol being made and cholesterol being consumed. But as we age, the end organs are not working as well. Ovaries are not doing as great a job of making the estrogens or testosterone. Testicles are not making the testosterone that we wanted them to make. Adrenals are no longer making as much as dehydroepiandrosterone and pregnenolone and so on. So as a consequence, our bodies see that these end organ hormones are declining. They're getting too low. And so your body starts ramping up cholesterol in an effort to drive those reactions. But no matter how much cholesterol your body produces, those failing ovaries, testicles, and adrenal glands can't make what you're trying to make. So what happens is you got two things going on. All of the end organ hormones are declining, and the cholesterol is rising in a futile effort to drive those end organ production. So what we're finding at longevity is if we give you back all eight of those hormones that you're trying to produce, all of a sudden your body doesn't have to raise the cholesterol so high. It now recognizes, I have enough pregnenolone, enough dehydroepiandrosterone, enough cortisol, enough testosterone, enough estradiol, enough progesterone. I don't need to make so much cholesterol. So all of a sudden, once we get all these other hormones up to where they used to be in your younger years, it becomes very easy to control cholesterol with simple diet and activity. So what is the right amount? Well, it's going to depend on, are you male? Are you female? Are you large? Are you small? Are you very physically active? Or are you sedentary? And what are your end organs producing? So at longevity, what we do, of course, is we measure not just the cholesterol. We measure the subtypes of cholesterol. We divide your LDL into three subtypes, your HDL into three subtypes, your intermediate cholesterols.
And it's the subtypes that make this really individual.
Yes.
Because you can't just look at the one capital top number.
That's right. And it's not just the subtypes, it's the particle sizes right. of each subtype. So we're measuring far more detail about the types of cholesterol you've got. We're looking at how much of it has been damaged, how much is not damaged. And then we are looking at all those other hormones that we need to balance in order to bring your cholesterol under good control without having to use things like the statins. Now, there are people that we have to use statins for. I don't diss statins, but statins don't just lower the cholesterol in your bloodstream. They lower the cholesterol in your brain. And so many people start getting fuzzy-headed and memory issues and, forgetful. Drowsy, their muscles start to hurt because they're losing the cholesterol metabolism in the muscles. So muscles start getting weak and unable to perform their duty very well. So about 5% of our patients require a statin to lower their cholesterol, but 95% of our people don't. 95% of our people, we have great cholesterol levels by addressing the underlying problem. So, dear Christopher, you've now heard it both from the email I sent you.
That'll teach you to write an email to Dr.
That's right.
That's right.
But I promised I would address it on the air for him. So
very good.
I have now done so.
I think I'll send you an email about the economy and the election. But definitely not ask on air.
No. You and I will discuss that one over a beer.
Maybe stronger.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Jerry Mixon. Dr. Mixon and Dr. Michael Gilbert here today talking about the eyes and whatever you would like to discuss about your health. This is Leading Edge Medicine. I'm going to give you that phone number to call so you can get in the queue just like Ben and Julie did. And we're going to take their calls in just a moment. Here it is, 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. 855-465-8770. We will be right back with more Leading Edge Medicine in just a moment.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started into hum.
See, he says things start to hum. I almost never hum. I whistle. They hear me coming down the hall and they say, Dr. Mixon's in the house.
He's
they hear
whistling. Me whistling. Yes. Welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine. We have Dr. Jerry Mixon here today to answer your questions. We also have from Northwest Vision Institute, Dr. Michael Gilbert.
Good morning, eye doctor.
Yeah. Yay. So we've got some eye questions already, so let's dive right in. We're going to take line one, Ben, calling in from Seattle. Welcome, Ben.
Hello, Ben.
Good morning, Ben.
Hello. Say, Dr. Mixon, I've heard you speak about rapamycin. So I've acquired it, but then I started to look into it a little bit, and I'm wondering if you can just give me your thoughts on what I'm concerned about, and I'll just read it off, and then maybe you can talk to me about it. One study I thought I saw indicated that rapamycin may shorten telomeres, so that was a concern. I'm also wondering, since this is an immunosuppressant, what you think about protection against COVID or RSV. I also saw that it may upregulate some cancer cells, and I'm wondering about how it should be taken, 3 milligrams, 6 milligrams, if you cycle on it, for example, 10 weeks on, 10 weeks off, or do you take it in long term? And just your all around thoughts about its safety and
what you've addressed a whole lot of issues with rapamycin. So let me start with this.
But does it help the eyes?
Actually, it
probably does, but
does.
I've never heard any data. So put that at the end.
I've actually got a paper or two on eyes for you.
So. I'm excited.
Well, I can answer that. I had my eye lenses replaced, and for a long time they've been relatively foggy. I've been on rapamycin a while, and I see much clearer for some reason.
Okay.
The only mechanism that would make any sense to me taking rapamycin is some impact to the tear film. But that's interesting. Yeah. I'd love to know more.
Okay, well, let's talk about rapamycin a little bit. First of all, it is, and whatever you're doing there, you're making...
There's a loud noise.
Yeah, loud noise, so you might want to mute. Okay? Okay. Rapamycin, when it was discovered back in 1979, I think it was, 78, 79, on the 64. Island of Rapa Nui.
Of course.
Which is why it's called rapamycin. It was found in the soil samples on the island of Rapa Nui. And it turned out to be an antifungal, antibacterial, and antiviral agent. So it kills bacteria, fungi, and viruses, which is really kind of fascinating. But it was approved by the FDA in the 90s for protecting against kidney transplant rejections. It was being used with immunosuppressants. And because it prevented rejection of transplants, it was classed by the FDA as a immunosuppressant. Mm-hmm. Now, immunosuppressants all have a couple of things in common. Every true immunosuppressant known to man raises the risk of cancers and raises the risk of dying from infections. Because if your immune system is suppressed, you are less able to fight infections or to find and kill cancer cells. So immediately when the FDA classed it as an immunosuppressant, everybody got concerned that it might cause cancer and et cetera. But it turns out that we now have nearly 30 years of experience with the drug that when you put these patients on rapamycin, you cut the risk of cancers in half. It does not raise the risk of cancer. It suppresses virtually every cancer known to man. It also does not make you more susceptible to infections. In fact, it seems to enhance the immune system in most ways, except for tissue rejection. So it acts as an immunosuppressant when it comes to tissue rejection, but not in all the other ways. Mm-hmm. But because it was classed originally as an immunosuppressant, all those other warnings of the classical immunosuppressants got put into the paperwork for rapamycin. Okay. So it does not do most of those things. Okay. Interestingly, it extends the lifespan of every animal it has ever been tried on. The only one we are not sure of are human beings. And that's because we live too long to do good studies. You know, laboratory mice live an average of 25 months. And so when you add rapamycin, they live longer. But it's a dose response, a direct dose response relationship. In moderate doses, you get 10 to 12% increase in lifespan. At high doses, you get about 15%. And it doesn't matter whether you give the rapamycin to young mice or old mice. All mice live longer with rapamycin, even when you don't start it until quite old age.
Oh.
Which is really kind of different. For instance, the other SIRT1 inhibitor that we know of is metformin.
Right.
And when you give metformin to young adult mice, you increase their lifespan by about 20%. If you give it to middle-aged mice, you only increase their lifespan by about 6%. And if you give it to elderly mice, you don't increase their lifespan at all. So metformin, while most of us older folks use it because it is also a SIRT1 inhibitor, you have to use it in youth to get the best extension of lifespan. Rapamycin's not that way. Rapamycin, you give it to old dogs, you give it to old marmosets, you give it to old everything, and they start functioning better for longer. Now, the question is,
that's powerful.
Yes.
Yes.
The question is, how much should we be using and how often we take it?
That's right.
And the answer is, nobody knows. All right. We have a lot of people with opinions. I have an opinion. What I don't have is data to prove that my opinion is right.
Okay. I value your opinion.
All right. When we use rapamycin for immunosuppressants, for transplant, to prevent transplant rejection, they're typically using 2 milligrams a day every day for years at a time. As long as you've got that other person's kidney in your body, you continue taking the rapamycin. So you might take 2 milligrams a day every day for 20 years.
Yeah.
Now, the problem with that is when you take that high a dose at 14 milligrams a day every day, you do get some alterations in the immune response. And the reason I phrased it that way is you don't get increased infections. But when you start measuring the peptides and the cytokines that go with immune protection, they're altered, they're changed. So that, we think, comes under CERT 2. There are, by the way, 11 CERTs. CERTs 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, etc. CERT 1 is the one we're trying to inhibit. Okay. On the other hand, CERT 6 provides longer lifespan.
Oh.
So we need a CERT 6 agonist and a CERT 1 inhibitor. The animal studies, though, when we use really high doses of rapamycin, the animals do better. But should they be taking it once a week, twice a week, every other day? We don't know. The closest we've got to high doses with people is a dog study done by Dr. Kaperlin over at UW. And he put these elderly dogs, some of them large dogs, weighing 90 pounds or so, about the size of a small woman, these elderly dogs were put on what in a human dose my size would be the equivalent of 28 milligrams a week.
A lot.
A lot. Because the most common doses are 4, 5, and 6 milligrams a week. He put those dogs on what would have been 28 milligrams a week on a dose per pound ratio. And in only 10 weeks, the dogs remodeled their hearts and improved their cardiac ejection fractions.
How long?
10 weeks.
10 weeks.
Very quickly, at very high doses. The dogs started acting like they were younger. They got their appetite back. They started playing.
Let me write
again.
Down that dose.
Yeah.
What was that dose again?
That's right. Yeah. Chewing shoes, yeah. Barking.
The downside is that high doses of rapamycin will raise both your blood sugar and your cholesterol.
That's right. Oops.
And so.
But you have a good time while it's there.
That's right. So I started. I'm a risk taker.
Right. Of course you are.
Yeah,
so what's the dose du jour?
That's right. So I started at 6 milligrams a week, and then I raised it up to 8, and then 10, and then 12, and then 14, and 16, and 18. And at 18 milligrams a week, taking it every other day, I saw that my hemoglobin A1C was up to 5.7, and my cholesterol was hitting 200, and I chickened out and backed my dose down. So
I had last heard this at 12, so I can see there's little constraint.
That's right.
Good.
You're taking 18 milligrams every other day?
I was taking a dose every other day. I was basically recreating what he did with his dogs.
Yeah.
And walking the doses up on a continuous basis. I'm now taking it once a week, and I'm taking about 12 milligrams a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm taking twice the dose that my doctors give to patients. And as I have explained many times on the air, I don't do that dose for patients. I do that dose for me. And the reason is very simple. If I do something stupid and hurt me, I do not sue me. If I do something stupid and hurt you, that's a whole different issue. I'll be talking to your attorney. And so...
And his doctor is currently in India right now and not hearing this information.
And she doesn't like it when I tell people I do for me, because...
Because they say, I think I want to do what...
Yeah, they say, people say, I want to do what Dr. Mixon does.
Not me. What was that dose
again?
Yeah.
Is that helpful for you, Ben?
Just one more thing. Do you take a vacation from it? I mean, do you do for 10 weeks and then stop for a while?
No, I don't. I know doctors who take it. They'll take it for 3 months and take 2 months off. I know other doctors who take it every other month. I know doctors who take it all the time.
What's the
animal studies
argument for intermittent dosing?
Well, again, they see the rising in the sugars and the cholesterol, and so they want to give those a chance to normalize.
Okay,
got it.
Okay, all right.
Thank you for that, Ben. We've got to run.
It.
All right.
Yep. I took way too long on that question.
No, fascinating.
And we may be talking more about rapamycin. So, Ben, stay there. We have another caller that's going to want. But we're going to talk about eyes in just a moment. Stay right there. Leading Edge Medicine continues. And if you have a question for either Dr. Jerry Mixon or Dr. Michael Gilbert, here's the number to call. It's 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. We'll be right back. Still going, isn't he? He must be using his rapamycin.
Or his dasatinib.
The stones start me up. You're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, and we are so glad that you're here today. Here is the number to get through, like so many have. We have some in the call queue, 1-800-465-8770. We have both Dr. Jerry Mixon here today, and for the eyes, Dr. Michael Gilbert from Northwest Vision Institute. So let's talk about the eyes. We have a caller calling in from Seattle. Julie, welcome to Leading Edge Medicine.
Hi, thank you. Good morning, everybody.
Hi, Julie.
Hi, my question is, during a cataract procedure, there's a method I know where you can correct astigmatism and
correct.
With a certain lens, or is it
multiple.
Lasers?
Yes.
Which one do you do? Do you do the lens or you do lasers?
Absolutely depends on the individual.
Oh, okay.
Everybody has some astigmatism. Oftentimes
yeah.
it's small enough that it's not visually significant, so then we don't worry about it. But honestly, I obsess about it on every patient just because that helps to optimize your uncorrected vision. So if you have a small amount, anytime you do surgery, you actually have an impact on the astigmatism. So I actually map out how I do the astigmatism or the surgery to address the astigmatism with every patient. Sometimes
oh, okay.
that mapping means all I need to do is be very precise. So we actually measure the patient. We measure the patient sitting up just before we go in the OR. Because
oh.
when you're lying down, your eye actually rotates a little bit. And since astigmatism is by the angle, it's a vector phenomena. So you have to get at very precise angles, and the eye rotates a little bit when you lie down. So we mark the eye, and then based on my pre-drawn map of that eye, we do the surgery to address the astigmatism. Now, your point about the implant is there's only so much there's a small amount I can do surgically that influences it. We have to incorporate that into our plan. But whatever we do with that, for larger amounts of astigmatism, we treat that, the bulk of it, with the astigmatism in the implant called a toric lens.
Yeah, okay.
Toric lenses have existed for forever. Forever, I kid. But we've had that in ophthalmology in our contact lenses, for instance, for decades, many, many decades. But we haven't had it in the implant except for about the last 10 years. Over that time, that technology has continued to improve. So we can correct large amounts of astigmatism. Large amounts are corrected with the toricity, the astigmatism built into the implant. And we have to do the surgery in such a way that it modifies that to refine it. Because astigmatism in implants comes in stepwise amounts, and we want very granular approach to get the exact amount that's likely to help that patient.
All right.
Did that answer what you're going after
did.
With
and
the toric lens?
So the report I have says my cylinder is -1.5 in both eyes. Is that significant, or is that...
I think it's significant. It's not large.
Yeah.
It depends on what you mean by significant.
Though.
Is it visually significant? Absolutely. If you don't correct that, it would make a significant difference in what you're able to see without glasses. Now, the important point is you could put that prescription, that astigmatism, in contacts or glasses after your surgery. But... if you want to be able to see without. So I had my astigmatism done when I had mine done. And I had a toric lens, even though I had a small amount, could have easily been done surgically. Mm-hmm. But I had the toric lens, and so my astigmatism's corrected. I see great without my glasses. Now, I was about as nearsighted as Dr. Mixon was before I had that surgery.
And that was about 2200.
Right.
Wow.
It was
worse
terrible.
Than me.
I was completely dependent on glasses and contacts.
Wow.
But in my work, I need that. I can't be dealing with glasses all the time. And you never see me with glasses in the office. I don't need them. I don't want them. I think I look better with them. So especially when we're doing videos, I'm going to wear my glasses because I look cooler, or at least cooler, whatever. So
now, the caller can't see it, but I am now putting on the glasses that my wife
and he also looks cool.
And yes, and these glasses have plain clear glass.
Right,
in them
exactly.
Because my wife said they make me look more studious.
Whoa!
Wow!
Professorial. Professor.
Wow, so, that's funny.
And mine too are clear up top, and they just give a little boost for near, because I can do that all day without it.
There we go.
But the point I was trying to make is that astigmatism can be corrected with glasses, with contacts. But if you want to be able to see without glasses and contacts, then the answer is do it in the lens. And And after all, since you use that vision every waking hour for the rest of your life, it just seems to me that, you know, it's a good investment. There's nothing, when the implants are put in, those almost certainly will last the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I had my surgery done in my 50s because I knew once done, it should last the rest of my life. And I knew that the surgery would be easier for the surgeon in my 50s than in my 60s, than in my 70s. And I wanted to be the easiest surgery he or she had to do all day long. So I wanted it done early, and I wanted to get rid of my nearsightedness so that I was functional, completely functional, without glasses. And that meant, even though I had half the amount of astigmatism, I had the toric lens to correct it.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's
so
encouraging.
You would see reasonably well without it, but do you know the rest of the prescription? How nearsighted or farsighted are you?
Well, let's see. Let's see what this says. So that's the OD.
That's for your glasses.
I just have that. I just have that report.
Just the astigmatism. I think it's enough to really to benefit from and justify the toric lens.
Yeah,
no question. If you were my patient, I'd be talking to you about the and there are multiple toric lenses. So that's just checking one box, because there are toric lenses that only give you distance or only give you near vision. But then there are toric lenses that can give you a range of vision. And that's really the leading edge of that technology, is how much range of vision and how does it achieve that? And there's multiple competing technologies that do that.
That's great. You know, my near vision isn't as, I mean, close up, I can still see pretty good.
But not distance.
Usually distance is, you know, stronger, weaker. But during the day, I don't wear anything for reading. And if it's light out, I can read books without reading glasses.
But you do need something for your best driving vision.
Yeah, for my best driving vision.
Okay, like, you know, so you're probably a little nearsighted, and the astigmatism is not causing much at near, but you do need to correct it for distance.
Yeah.
So the implant technologies today, were you to do the cutting edge multifocal or extended range lenses, you should be able to correct the astigmatism, see well, much better than driver's license vision without glasses at distance, and my average patient can read without glasses as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, great. Thank you. You answered my question.
Good. Good luck. I think it's an exciting area, and once done, should last the rest of your life.
Yeah, sounds wonderful.
Here's the problem with that.
Uh-oh. What's the problem?
Uh-oh.
The problem with that is, if you're like me, you hear about all the newer and newer technology.
Oh.
I had mine done 10 or 12 years ago.
I have to.
And now I'm sitting here, you know, with a case of envy.
I envy.
So, you know, it's such a good point. I think about this this daily, because people ask me, well, if I choose this one and something better comes, can I switch? And I said, no, but there is an eraser at the end of that pencil. So, you know, we can talk about that. But in turn, the risk of changing out lenses is much higher than doing it right. But I have total peace with that, because much as you, because I know your story and mine is very similar, I have had so much powerful benefit over the decade, minus 10 years, since I had it done, that I wouldn't trade that for anything.
No trade.
Now, is it possible to change them out? No, I do lament a little bit that the implants I'm talking to patients all day long are better in more, you know, I give patients better vision than I have, which I'm glad, so fine. But the next step in that technology is there is a laser in development that can alter the optics of the implant inside your eye and upgrade the optics.
Yes.
Right, without switching out the implant.
We've talked about that in the past.
And so that's still...
I'm waiting for it to get the FDA approval.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I'm very impressed with the research that has been done so far, but not through the FDA yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exciting technology.
I had my lenses switched out, it's probably 12, 14 years now.
Yeah.
And so I had one of the early crystal lenses put in, which was cutting edge for its day. It's a little archaic now. There's fancier, newer, better stuff out now. But, I went from 2200 and kind of dim yellow lenses. Right. I didn't see very well in dim light, you know, so. And for the first 10 years, I didn't need reading glasses at all. Now I'm finding at 77 that I'm starting to need reading glasses if the print is too small or the light is too dim.
Crystal lens was cutting edge for quite a while, and I'd used it for a long time. I did that for my brother. But the evolutionary steps have taken us away from that, mainly because the crystal lens integrated with the ciliary body, which is that part of the eye that focuses the lens.
Right.
It's one of the few lenses, it's the only FDA-approved lens, there are some others, but just experimental, that integrate with that lens, and the holy grail there was to get a lens that would respond to those muscles the same way the youthful eye did.
Yeah. And it worked great for me for the first 10 years or so.
And it does, but we find that some people can't retrain that muscle, so the results are variable. And those who can, sometimes that ability decreases with time, which is frustrating.
It is.
Until we get the laser that can fix it.
That's right. I hate this concept of, you know, my body doesn't work as perfectly as it once did.
Maybe more rapamycin.
Just sat in a... We'll talk about that with a new caller.
Very good. Perfect.
That's right. That's right. I hope that's helpful for you, Julie.
Thank you.
Take care, Julie.
All right.
Good luck.
And we're going to talk about ocular migraines with Dr. Michael Gilbert next on Leading Edge Medicine. If you have a question for Dr. Gilbert or for Dr. Jerry Mixon, here's that number to call. 1-800-465-8770. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Leading Edge Medicine, here with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Michael Gilbert. So if you have an eye question, today's the day to get those eye questions answered. In fact, we've got another one for you, Dr. Gilbert. We're going to take a call from Bothell. We have Mavis on the line. Good morning.
Morning, Mavis.
Hello, Mavis.
Good morning. Good morning. So, ocular migraines, what causes them? How can you prevent them, and are they a kind of a stroke?
Great question, and I think either Dr. Mixon or I can answer this, but I certainly see many more patients who come in for this and have a chance to talk to them. Oftentimes, they're concerned of what's going on in my eye. Well, I think the first thing to understand is if it's a true migraine, and sometimes we have to differentiate. We have to do a comprehensive eye exam to make sure that it's not something in the eye. But an ocular migraine is happening in the brain, not in the eye. Mm-hmm. The eye is just the camera, and it's the control room that has the problem. And so it's that same vasomotor spasms that are associated with either the ocular component of the migraine, the headache component of the migraine, or the classic syndrome that starts with average 20, 30 minutes of visual phenomena. And then as that goes away, the headache starts. But that's going on in the brain. And so whether you have your eyes open or closed, you can turn off the cameras and you're going to see the same phenomena going on. How can you stop them? Well, I think, I have a couple answers. Neither are really as helpful as I wish they could be. First of all, there's no magic way to prevent them. There are drugs that suppress migraines. I think the most important thing is to pay attention, maybe a diary or something, to pay attention to what you were doing, eating, smelling, feeling around the time that you have these phenomena. because there are often triggers. And the triggers tend to be individual, but there's some very common ones. Caffeine, red wine, stress, temperature for some people, light for some people. So there are many different things, and it's very individual, right? So you have to pay attention to what triggers it for you. While there are medications that suppress migraines, I don't know of anyone that recommends those for ocular migraines. So you'd have to tell me what your ocular migraine experience is, and, you know, maybe we could figure out what you should do if they're really debilitating. So one interesting thing, and this has never been studied, but there was an interesting study that showed that there is a glaucoma drop that's been around for forever. Timolol is a beta blocker. And while the systemic absorption is, I think of it as trivial, it turns out the study showed that a very high percentage of patients who have migraines can decrease the intensity and the length of them substantially by taking a drop of this when they get their migraines. What it didn't address is that true for ocular migraines? But I would see no mm-hmm. reason that it would not be. So if they're prolonged and really intrusive, then, you know, maybe that or any of the other migraine medications can be used. But usually they're not so frequent nor so intrusive that it's worth the risk and exposure to take those drugs. So how often do you get them?
Well, and how long do they last when they occur?
Yeah, exactly. How intrusive is this?
Okay. So it'll start out by I'll be noticing I'm getting a little blurry spot on a part of my eye, either the right or the left.
Yeah.
And so as soon as I see that, I go, okay. So I close my eyes, and I can sure enough, I'll see the little squigglies. And yep. then I start seeing a little bit of a headache coming on. And then it just kind of intensifies just a little bit, but enough to be aware of it. But not so much I have to go run and get some medicine or anything. And then I notice that sometimes I can't really, I'm not very, like if I hear a name, I go, what's that name? I can't really understand. And that this will go on for a few minutes. And then it goes away, you know, and then I'm fine. And then it comes back like every couple months or 3 months, sometimes years.
How long does that whole process last? How much is it? How long is this bond?
Maybe 15, 20 minutes.
Okay. So I think what you've described goes beyond what I would call an ocular migraine, because you're now involving both the headache and hearing sense. So I think it would be worth seeing your primary care doctor or a neurologist and talk to them. On the other hand, if it's 15 minutes every 3 months, I'm not sure I would want to be on systemic medications to suppress it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's worth it. Right. Certainly, I'd not, Dr. Mixon probably has heard, people come to me if their vision's involved.
Yeah.
If their hearing is involved, they don't mention it to me, right? So I haven't heard of migraines, ocular or otherwise, being associated with hearing change.
Well, migraines in general,
I can have
sensorium changes.
Sure.
So, and she's getting the pain, which says she's getting more than just the ocular migraine.
So, one interesting thing. Years ago, there used to be an occasional meeting. As Dr. Mixon knows, most medical meetings are single specialty. I go to an ophthalmology meeting, I see just eye doctors, period.
Yeah.
And those are the meetings. And the only difference is where it's held in the country and how many people are coming. Is it national, international, statewide, whatever? But we did have a series every couple years. We would have a regional meeting where joint between neurology and ophthalmology. And it's fascinating, because you learn what other people are seeing in patients that you share. And one of the talks was about migraines. And the neurologist who was giving the talk said, migraines never involve just the vision part. It's just a prodrome to the headache. Mm-hmm. And all of the ophthalmologists, you know, just got wide-eyed, if you'll forgive me, wide-eyed, and, you know, immediately challenged that, because, of course, those people who have just the visual changes don't go see that fella.
That's right.
They come to see me. Right. So we see those mm-hmm. people all day long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, back in my country doctor days, I would see the people that were disabled with pain.
Yes, of course. You know,
and they'd be bedridden
right.
for a day or two with their severe migraines. And
those need medication.
And
too.
The medications right. we used for
right.
those were very different than
of
we
course.
Would use just for a 5 or 10 minute
yeah.
wavy lines in
right.
your vision.
Right. I said, if I have that, mm-hmm. and sometimes I do, mine are really trivial, I kind of sit back and enjoy it. because, and especially because I talk to patients every day about this phenomena. Mm-hmm. And so for me to get just a taste of it, and mine are so trivial, it doesn't really count, but I just kind of watch it and say, yeah, I can imagine this would be disruptive, especially were I driving mm-hmm. and if it were larger mm-hmm. or more intrusive in the vision.
Mm-hmm. Hope that
right.
helps.
The first time, that happened, I ran to the doctor. And he said he couldn't see any stroke signs of stroke or anything. So every time I've had one since then, I haven't taken it seriously. But you're saying probably see a neurologist and just kind of check things out.
Yes. Well, the thing that worries me about it is it sounds almost like you're getting a little confusion.
Right.
You know,
you're not understanding.
Yeah, you're not understanding words or phrases.
Yes.
And that tells me that the brain writ large is now involved, and I'd always love to get the opinion of a neurologist.
That's the part that makes me think you should have neurologists talk to you about it. The hearing involved, and more importantly, the effect in the brain has me at least interested to see what they have to say about it, because I have not heard that as a part of a common migraine.
And you know of a good neurologist?
No, I was not impressed with the last neurologist I saw. So, I hate it when
my favorite neurologist retired, which is often the case for really good doctors.
Doctors in our age group
are saying, thank you very much. I'm tired of this.
See you later. Bye.
Yeah. No, the last neurologist I saw, I was getting some altered sensation in the soles of my feet.
Uh-huh.
I had a little neuropathy down there, and I wanted to know what was going on and so on. And he examined me, and he said, yep, you've got a little bit of neuropathy here.
Thank you.
I said, that's normal for your age.
I told you that when I came in.
That's right. You know, you got that from the history.
Next step.
Now what do I do? So yeah, I was not terribly impressed with the neurologist I saw. Nor was I impressed with the $1,200 bill he sent me.
Oh,
so, to tell me what I already knew when I walked in the door.
Well, thank you very, very much. You folks are
thank you for calling.
So helpful, and we really appreciate you being there for us.
Take care, my dear.
Fun bye-bye. To chat with you.
Thank you for the call, Mavis.
Good luck.
All right, you're listening to Leading Edge Medicine, and we have some more callers talking about the eyes. So, Dr. Michael Gilbert.
I'm excited.
Yes, you get ready for those. If you'd like to call in on the show, 1-800-465-8770 is the number to call. That's 1-800-465-8770. We're going to take a quick break here. Then we are going to talk more about cataracts in just a moment. So stay there. This is Leading Edge Medicine.